Good morning and welcome to Storylines. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. Today we're speaking with author Steve Pitt about his 30-year career as a freelance writer and author. We're going to learn more about his latest book, The Whale of the Wendigo, an early adventure of Pierre Trudeau. Steve, thanks so much for stopping by the studio.
My pleasure.
And we have an extra guest in case our listeners hear your dog's name.
Her name is Chaka. That's a Tamil for chocolate.
Okay.
And she's a hound, so anytime she hears it, you'll hear her if she hears anything. So.
Well, we'll enjoy her chiming in.
Okay.
Steve, one of your most endearing traits is your sense of humor, and I know you'll have a philosophic gem or two to share with us, but tell us first about the Groundhog Recipe article that earned you an author's award for humor.
Well, it was for Harold Smith magazine, back when it was what I'd call a back-to-nature type of magazine. It later became sort of a lifestyle thing. But they did a lot of recipes, and I come from a farming background. My uncles were always forever out hunting groundhogs. Anyways, Harold Smith was always doing all these wonderful recipes for organic meat and all that sort of thing. And they had an article about getting rid of groundhogs, and I thought I'd put the two together. So, and I came up with five gourmet recipes for groundhog meat.
And that kind of put you on the map in terms of comedic writing.
That was my first, big sale. I had sold a joke to Playboy before that. That was my first actual dollar I ever earned as a professional writer. And it was so easy to do. It took me 5 minutes to write the joke, and I made $50. So I immediately thought, this is 1979. I said, boy, you can get rich writing in Canada. So that's when I decided to embark on a writing career, not knowing that that was the easiest $50 I'll ever make. And after that, it was a lot of work.
Yeah. And can you remember the joke? Can you share it on
well,
radio?
Well, it was nothing too risque. It was actually, typically, it was nonfiction. It was about a member of parliament who did a tour of the Arctic, and he found what he thought was a whalebone on the beach. And he took it back and he used it as a gavel to convene meetings in the Parliament Hill buildings. And a visiting Inuit happened to see him convening the meeting. And afterwards, he asked the man if he knew what he had. Well, he was pointing at all his fellow politicians and he said, well, it's a whalebone. And the Inuit hunter said, no, actually, it's a petrified walrus penis. So I submitted it to Playboy as when one member fails to recognize another.
Oh, well, that's very Steve Pitt. Picturesque humor.
Well, I still have the check stub mounted on my wall. It said my name, Stephen Pitt, and after that, I had the Playboy sign. It says walrus penis.
Oh, so I still have
that framed on my wall.
Well, you know, your book, Running to Extremes, was listed in the Globe and Mail's bestseller list in October 2012, and it ranked number 5 in the Canadian nonfiction category. So can you give us a bit of background on the book and then describe what it felt like to find yourself listed in such a who's who of bestsellers?
Well, I was behind Stephen Colbert and Arnold Schwarzenegger on that list, but I was ahead of Salman Rushdie. So that made me feel good that at least I was beating Salman Rushdie. But the book, I was introduced to this long-distance marathon runner by a friend of mine, Eric Walters, who's a very prolific children's author, and he had met Ray at one of those where they had a notable people coming up and making speeches, and he met Ray and he says, you know, I think Steve should write a book. Actually, Eric was going to write a fiction book on the same subject, but he likes the way I write nonfiction. So he said, maybe Steve and I should do sort of a double release. And we both, we released the book at the same time through Penguin. And so I wrote a nonfiction story of Ray, who is a very amazing runner. He was one of those guys who had no focus in his life up until about his 30th birthday. And he just, it was a turning of the millennium, and he decided that he was going to turn his life around. And he just took up long distance running. And it wasn't just marathon running. It was ultra marathon, which is usually 2 marathons in 1 day.
Wow.
You do that for 5 or 6 days in a row till you've covered sometimes 500, sometimes 1,000 kilometers.
And it obviously sold very well to put you at number 5 on the bestsellers list.
It did. It was picked up also for a Forrester Reading nomination. I didn't win, but being nominated for the Forrester Reading always helps.
Was it a YA novel?
Yes.
And do you think it inspired kids or the teachers that were having their kids read it?
I think that's what the whole aim was. In fact, Ray Zahab's The Runner's story is an inspirational story. He has a website called Impossible to Possible, where he inspires people because his life was a bit of a mess until he turned it around. He smoked heavily. He took alcohol and drugs occasionally. And he just decided, okay, if I'm going to be addicted to something, it's going to be to running, which is good for my health. He did it so well that he became world. He ran across the Sahara Desert,
good
he and two
heavens.
Other guys. And he also holds the world record for running to the South Pole unassisted.
So this was truly an inspiration.
It is an inspiration. Yes. He's an ongoing. He's still out there running. It just wow. I haven't talked to him recently. The book was kind of strange in that we were communicating by email. And every time I talked to him, he was in a different different desert or mountain range. He'd be in the Gobi Desert 1 week, and then by the time I got a revision, I'd send it to him, and he'd be over somewhere in Death Valley somewhere, maybe, or the Amazon jungle.
Giving you his comments.
Yes, a lot of the time he said, well, you can't use that story. He'd tell me a story, but he said, that would get me in trouble with the others, because it'd be something a little bit risque. So I said, well, you can't use that story, which is the biggest frustration. I made a decision after that to never again work with a living, just by I found working with a living author or a living subject can be a more of a challenge, and if they're passed away, they can't really come back for revisions.
Yes. In the context of being recognized on a who's who list of bestsellers, you've talked often in our conversations together about supporting your habit, your work as a writer with a pretty intriguing list of jobs. And I think some of the more colorful ones are goose rancher and infantry soldier, movie extra, Yukon gold prospector, armored truck guard. So have many of your workplace experiences found their way into your articles and stories?
A lot of the time, especially with my last book, which we'll talk about a little later, I went up as a Yukon gold prospector for a summer. My sister happened to marry a Yukon gold prospector, and I ended up there for two summers just helping them out on a gold claim. And that was my background for writing my last book. But it does creep in. Like, I've done so many different things. I can look at a world from a cook's point of view, or I can look at things from a truck driver's point of view. I've even worked as a youth worker.
Yes, and actually, we talked a bit about that. How did that, I guess, inform some of the YA books that you've written?
One of the books I did a couple books ago, one called Creepy Crawly, and it was about a boy who's at a new school, and he's sort of befriended by a kid that nobody else likes. The nickname they call him is Creepy Crawly. His real name is Mike Crawly, and so they call him Creepy. This kid does not want to be friends with him, but as these things happen, they eventually do become close friends, and the young man finds out why this kid is acting so strange is the fact that his father has a mental illness.
Okay.
And so it's just the way this kid has to cope and act accordingly because of his family situation. And I encountered that a lot when I was working a youth outreach worker up in the Jane Finch area.
So you really have used so many of your experiences to transform a bad situation into a teaching tool.
Yes. Or just it's life experience. I'm always amazed that I often meet some very talented young writers, and I often wonder, how the heck do they ever get a decent story? Because they haven't done anything yet. I guess I'm more of the old school. I don't really have much of imagination, but I observe things, so I can put it together 20 years later. In fact, when I'm driving up here, I was thinking of my next book and all the different elements that I can work in.
I'm always amazed at your retention. Since I've known you, you seem to be able to remember things that I was at the same meeting or I was at the same get-together, and I sure can't remember any of that. So you've got an amazing ability to recall things, and I guess that also feeds into your writing because you bring back things from, as you say, 20 years ago to put into your work.
I'm finding, actually, as I get older, I'm starting to remember the stuff. It's almost like my brain's rebooting, or that I'm coming back to everything I did in my teens and my 20s is coming back to me a lot better than what I did last week.
Okay.
I don't know why that's the way the memory works, or maybe it's bubbling to the surface. But it's another thing that I'm finding, that writing for young adults these days, I tend to set them in past, because when I look at kids today with their technology, I have no idea what they're doing anymore.
Right. To write about that, you feel you need a little bit more technical background.
Yes.
But you can write about the past.
Yes, growing up in the 50s and 60s comes much more naturally to me. And I think I would probably sound false. Although my dad used to embarrass me when I was in my teens. He'd come in and try to talk hippie talk to my friends, you know, whatever he'd seen on TV, and he'd try to,
and it didn't carry.
It always sounded like Bob Hope trying to be a hippie. Whereas I think that I'd sound the same way because the technology these days is changing like every 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and you'd start a book, and by the time you finished, it's already outdated itself.
Yes.
Yeah. And now I want to talk about your latest book, The Wail of the Wendigo, which was released last fall as part of the Leaders and Legacy series published by Fireside.
Yes.
I'd like to hear more about the story and the research that went into that book, but can you first tell us a little bit about the Leaders and Legacy series and how you became one of its stable authors?
Well, the book series has been started by a publisher, a small-time publisher in Whitby, Ontario, called Roderick Benz. And his idea was that Canadian students don't know as much about our own history as we do about American and British history. And so his idea was to create readable stories like Hardy Boy Adventures with Canadian historic figures. So, because look at the Americans, you can see all kinds of things about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, even Mark Twain has become a fictional character in a lot of stories. So he started off with a couple of prime ministers. One of them was Lester Pearson, I believe, and there is one John Diefenbaker. And I got lucky. I got Pierre Trudeau, who is somebody I really, I not only lived through his era, but I also admired him in many ways. I didn't agree with everything he ever did, but I was always admiring him.
And how timely! Now we need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to hear more about the Wail of the Wendigo, which not only features a young Pierre Trudeau, but a young Pierre Burton.
Yes.
So stay with us on Storylines on Hunter's Bay Radio. Welcome back to Storylines. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. And today we're speaking with author Steve Pitt. Steve, before the break, we talked about Fireside's Leaders and Legacies series and your latest book, The Wail of the Wendigo, which is part of that series.
Yes.
And the book has been described as a sort of Hardy Boys meets Goosebumps. So tell us more.
Well, Roderick wanted to set the story up in the Yukon, which is one of the reasons that I got attracted to the project. I have a background in the Yukon, or at least being up there a couple summers. And the original idea is to have some problem-solving Nancy Drew or Hardy Boy adventure. So I decided to add the Wendigo element. Because about 10 years ago, I wrote an article for Legion magazine about Wendigos, and I was quite fascinated. It's a Wendigo, in case you don't know. It's sort of like a werewolf crossed with a vampire.
And is this particular to First Nations?
It is. It's okay. a original Canadian or North American monster, but it's our very own monster. And it sort of passes through all the different tribes of the North. And it's basically, a Wendigo is a human being who turned to cannibalism for a reason, starvation or whatever. And once you become a cannibal, you turn into this monster with supernatural powers, and sometimes they revert back. People, there's legends of people going, talking to a person, and 2 weeks later, there's this monster in the same place. So anyways, I decided when I started working this story together, I had Pierre Trudeau go to the Yukon. That was Roderick's idea, the publisher, because he wanted to set something up in the Yukon because no prime ministers are from there.
Okay, so and this was the way to do it.
So, okay. And he wanted me to mention Pierre Burton as a passing character, but I found once they met each other in my book that because they were similar age and similar brilliant minds, that they actually made a good duo.
So and did they like each other?
Not at first. At first, like a lot of good friends, they hated each other at first because they both thought the other one was a bit of a snob and pretentious intellectual. And actually, I had some first knowledge of Pierre Burton as a young boy because my brother-in-law's mother knew him as a child because
okay.
She grew up in Dawson City. So she was able to tell me what he was like as a young man.
So real insight
yes.
That you could put into the book.
Yeah, just little quirks such as he wore spectacles and he had red hair that his mother parted down the middle, so he looked like a little owl. And so I mentioned that in the story several times that Pierre Trudeau thinks that he always calls it the L-face kid. And anyways, so they become friends, and when they get taken way into the woods to work on a gold claim, this monster, at first they mistake for a grizzly bear, but it starts taking on all kinds of qualities that they know. They're up against something a little more scary than a grizzly bear.
And so we learn through the story how they deal with that.
Yes.
And then, I guess we don't want any spoilers, but do the two Pierres resolve the problem?
They become good friends and resolve the problem through the... I had to add a strong female character into the story because, unfortunately, we've only had the one female prime minister. But also, I believe that the story, most of my stories always have a strong female lead character too, because female readers need someone to identify with.
Yes.
Plus, I also believe there's no such thing as just a strong male character without a female somewhere as a team.
Yes.
So they meet a First Nation girl who helps them. She teaches them both how to hunt and also how to cope with this monster. And it also allowed me to introduce the residential school story into the system, too. So the book's been commended for all the different historical facts. I even have a mention of Prime Minister Thompson, who opens up the book as a vampire. So it's a story within a story, where Pierre Trudeau's father takes this story about Prime Minister Thompson as a vampire and throws it in the fire and says, you shouldn't read that kind of trash because it'll rot your brain out. And so I'm sort of parodying my own book.
Yes.
At the very beginning.
Obviously, a ton of research went into this.
Yes, although I'm a history nut anyway. anyways. A lot of this stuff was just background information. All I had to do is go back and double-check my facts to get the dates right.
And you retain this stuff, as we mentioned earlier.
Yes.
I found you to be truly one of those walking encyclopedias.
Well, my father used to refer to me as a fountain of useless information, but I decided to turn that fountain into some kind of career as a writer. But it's just to me, history is fascinating because it also repeats itself so often. So you can see themes that are happening in 1900 that are happening in 2016.
So true. So true. And the Wendigo, the Wail of the Wendigo is your eighth book?
Or it's my tenth.
Your tenth book. Wow.
Yeah, I'm sorry, my website isn't quite up to date if you're counting on.
So where can people find your books?
Usually, if you go to any store that can order them.
Okay.
They're all still in print.
And Dundurn publishes a lot of them.
Dundurn publishes. I've got books with Penguin, Pearson, McClellan Stewart, which has become Random House, which has become Random Penguin now.
Yes.
And Fireside is the first time I've dealt with them, and I really like that. What I like with the smaller publishers is I'm the big fish in their pond.
Oh, yes.
Whereas at Penguin, I wasn't even a goldfish in their pond. So.
And we like to talk about the writing life on this show, because it's so encouraging for writers who haven't broken into print to hear the experiences of seasoned writer, and you've had multiple publishers. So.
Yes.
Pearls of Wisdom.
Well, I learned that from Eric Walters, who he has publishers chasing him around, asking for manuscripts. I'm not quite at that stage yet, but at least because I've spread myself across a spectrum of publishers, I can take. Sometimes you take it to one publisher, they don't like it, take it to the next, and eventually you'll find a home for it. So I think it's better to play the field, as you'd call it.
Right, and maybe not always stick with the same publisher.
Especially, you look at the book, and I also write a very diverse range of books.
Articles, the magazines you write for are all over the map.
Which is sort of my life story. I must have one of those problems where I can't stick to anything for much more than 6 months.
Or you have such diverse interests and you're able to speak intelligently about all of them. You know, we have just a few minutes left, and I want to talk about the plaque that you're working on near.
Up in Rutherglen, there's going to be a plaque erected to a most incredible person. I found out about her first. I was just Googling. I live on a lake called Talon Lake, up near Rutherglen in Bonfield Township,
which is between
Mattawa and North Bay. I was looking for easy canoe routes, and one of the ones suggested was from my lake to Pimsey Lake, which is just about 2 miles away. And then the minute I put up Pimsey Lake, somebody mentioned there's a naturalist writer there. And I said, there was another writer in my ear. So I started reading about her. But she wasn't just a writer. She started off as she was a Swedish aristocrat. And during World War I, she trained as a Red Cross nurse, served as an army nurse, fell in love with a Russian officer like Dr. Zhivago. When the Civil War broke out, she married him. He went ahead to try to save Russia from the Bolsheviks. After a couple of months of waiting, she followed him by train and by dog sled. And they were finally reunited just in time to be captured by the Bolsheviks. And they were separated. She, as a nurse, was allowed to work helping Russian orphans, whereas he was shot by the Bolsheviks. When she found this out several years later, so she came to Canada. This is now the 1920s, and she became an outpost nurse in northern Ontario. And she used to do the rounds in the Bonfield, Mattawa area by dog sled and by car. She delivered lots of babies. In those days, there was no hospitals. There were no doctors up there. It was just a nurse.
And she wrote about this.
She wrote about that, but she didn't really seriously start writing until she retired. Oh, she's also the head nurse for the Dion Quince. And after she retired from that, that's when she retired from nursing, and she married this local carpenter named Lynn Lawrence. And she settled down in the woods in this little cabin out in the middle of nowhere in a place called Pimsey Lake. And just then, World War II breaks out, and Lynn joins the army and left her alone for the next 5 years. And she had nothing to do. Someone gave her a book of bird watching.
Yes.
And she got really heavily into that with nothing else to really occupy her time. And she wrote the author of the book, who happened to be the head of the Canadian Natural Museum in Ottawa. And he was so impressed with her letter, he sent her a letter back saying, you should take this up seriously. And she went on to become a world-class ornithologist.
Oh, my goodness.
She was an elected member of the American Audubon Society.
And so now where is this plaque going to be?
It's going to go, there's a little park on Pimsey Lake. If you're driving between North Bay, if you're heading towards Mattawa, halfway between, you'll find on Highway 17 this little park called Pimsey Lake Park. And the plaque will be about 200 meters from where her cabin was. In fact, she when she passed away in 1992, she was buried there too.
Okay.
So it's going to be within 200 meters of where her final resting place, but also where she did all her writing.
Are there book titles you could refer people to, or just give us her name again? And
her name is Louise de Caroline Lawrence.
Okay.
If you looked her up, you'd see that she was also a Dundurn author. That was the other thing that struck me by sheer coincidence. I found out she's got the same publisher as one of the ones I dealt with.
How, you know, it comes full circle, doesn't
it? Yeah, that's why I'm always finding there's always these weird little coincidences. The fact that we live within 2 miles of each other and the fact we had the same publisher and we knew some of the same people. Like when I found out who she knew, I said, oh, I know that person.
So you really felt moved to honor her in this way?
Yes. I have to say that I didn't create this plaque by myself, The Nipissing Naturalist. If you want to find out more about her, look up on the website. That's a local conservation group. They're the ones who are helping to raise the money for the plaque, which costs $5,000.
Okay. So, and this is all in addition to all the writing that you do?
Yes, sir. That's my way of escape writing. I don't know about you, but there's 100 things I'd rather do than write. I'd rather go chop wood or
Rather be writing, but just seems easier to do everything else besides writing. It's always easier.
I have to strap myself into a chair. It's a deadline thing that forces me to actually finally get down to it. I'm one of those people that I said, you know, I'd rather be making soup.
Yeah, and responding to a deadline pretty much is what gets most of us, doesn't it?
That's one of my things. I've never missed a deadline. It's darn near killed me a few times. But it's one of those things that you need to do that as a writer. You can't.
You need a fire lit sometimes under
you. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Steve, it's really been such a pleasure to have you on Storylines. Thanks so much for stopping by the studio.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Storylines on Hunter's Bay Radio. Today we've been speaking with author Steve Pitt. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and I'm here every Thursday morning at 10:05 a.m. talking to authors and book folks about books and the writing life. Thanks for listening. Please join us again. I'm just going to take a moment to mention the Muskoka Novel Marathon that runs this year from July 8th to 11th to raise funds and support of the YMCA of Simcoe Muskoka Literacy Services. I jumped on board this year as one of 40 writers who will pump out a manuscript in just 72 hours. If you haven't already heard of the Novel Marathon, or if you haven't yet sponsored a writer, please go to MuskokaNovelMarathon.com. To find out more, choose a writer to sponsor, and sure, you can sponsor me. I would love that and very much appreciate it. It all goes to the same great cause, so please help us help to bring the joy and wonder of reading to folks who have been missing out on so much. Thank you for everything you contribute to the cause.